It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to a guest who says it's time for us to have a national town hall on problems related to football.
But first, we're talking to a political scientist about some of last night's elections. The biggest news out of the results were the gubernatorial elections in Virginia and New Jersey and the mayoral election in New York City.
Here to talk about these results and what they mean for Democrats and Republicans in future elections is Kyle Kondik. He's managing editor of Sabatow's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Kyle, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So one of the closest races yesterday in your neck of the woods in Virginia, the race for governor, Democrat Terry McAuliffe beat Republican Ken Cuccinelli. What can we take away from the results there?
Well, this was a really fascinating race to watch because McAuliffe and Cuccinelli were unusually unpopular candidates. Both of them had generally had their favorability or their unfavorability numbers were higher than their favorability numbers, and that both are kind of figures that I think people who follow politics know nationally. Ken Cuccinelli was kind of a controversial state attorney general here in Virginia, and Terry McAuliffe is the chief fundraiser for the Clintons and a former chairman of the Democratic National Committee. And the contrast between essentially a professional fundraiser and a pretty strident social conservative turned off a lot of voters. There was a kind of unknown libertarian candidate who got about 6.5% of the vote, which is pretty high in Virginia for a third-party candidate, and I think that showed the general dissatisfaction with the two choices.
A lot of eyes on Virginia yesterday. It's a swing state in presidential elections. It's a really interesting contrast between urban areas and rural areas. Do people around the country look at this as maybe a little laboratory for a congressional election, a presidential election?
Yeah, I think they do, and I think to a certain extent they're right to do so. Virginia, of all 50 states, Virginia was actually closest to the national presidential voting in 2008 and 2012. So it was kind of the midpoint of the election in both elections. And I think naturally people are looking at it. And, you know, here's the other thing. You know, most political reporters are in Washington, D.C. A lot of them live in Virginia, and so they care a lot about what's going on in their backyard.
It's local news for them.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the other thing, too, is that this was only one of two gubernatorial races. The other one was in New Jersey where, you know, Chris Christie is a huge national figure, but that race was very, very uncompetitive, and the Virginia one was pretty competitive and actually was a little bit closer than the polls indicated on election night.
Well, and the two different sides at various points in that election were trying to make it a referendum on national issues, trying to blame Republicans on the one hand for the government shutdown, blaming the Democratic candidate, linking him to the Affordable Care Act and the troubled release so far. Is that something, as far as you could tell, that voters in Virginia were paying attention to?
Yeah, I think they were, although what was interesting about this race is that even though the polls were kind of weren't really right, they didn't move a ton during October. I think that this race was pretty steady since the late summertime. And I think that was sort of this I think even though we had these big national events happening in Washington, I don't know if they necessarily moved the numbers all that much, although it may be fair to say that a number of Republicans sort of came home to Ken Cuccinelli, perhaps as a result of the bad Obamacare rollout. That may have cost McAuliffe a point or two when it was all said and done.
Before we travel up to New Jersey, is there a tendency to maybe overread an election like this in an odd-numbered year, and it's one of the few data points we have, and we over-extrapolate from this one unique case?
That is an excellent point, and I couldn't have said it better myself. You know, there definitely is a tendency, again, because you know, the Virginia gubernatorial race is one of the only games in town for people to look at. You sometimes see this same dynamic in special congressional elections when, you know, you'll have a special election in, you know, March of the election year or something, and something unexpected happens and people want to turn it into a national referendum and on what's going to happen. And the truth is, I think it's dangerous to do that, particularly in this Virginia race, because A, the midterm election is only is still a year away, and B, I think these candidates were unusually unpopular. And so it was a unique race. that, while very interesting to cover, I don't necessarily know if it tells us a ton about what's going to happen next year.
Theoretically, both parties would elect more, I guess, likable candidates for president, say, in 2016.
Yeah, and that's a good transition to New Jersey.
Let's head up there. Yeah, so this was, Virginia was a close race. New Jersey, was it even a race at all?
I mean, you could make an argument that, Christie was effectively unopposed. Barbara Buono is the Democrat who ran against him, but she had very little actual national party support. And there's a lot of big hitter Democrats in New Jersey that took a pass on this race, most notably Cory Booker, the former mayor of Newark, who is now in the U.S. Senate. He won a special Senate election a few weeks ago. And, you know, Christie, even though New Jersey is a blue state, Christie is an unusually talented politician. I also think that his handling of Hurricane Sandy, which was a huge deal, of course, in New Jersey right before the presidential election last year, I think that was really helpful to Christie's favorability amongst voters. I mean, I think Christie was always going to win, but sometimes handling a natural disaster can be helpful to a politician if it's handled properly. We've seen that in some other places, and so, you know, you put all that stuff together, and it made for a very sleepy race. And all everybody cares about now with New Jersey and Christie is whether Christie's going to run for president.
I think
he probably will, and he'd probably be a fairly significant contender on the Republican side.
Any signs from the numbers in that election or from his acceptance speech that might point toward that run?
Well, you know, he did really, really well. And he can point to that and say, hey, I'm electable. I have crossover appeal. But I think there are a lot of Republicans who don't really like him all that much. Although it's really interesting that, you know, Christie was elected in 2009, and he became really notable to, I would say, conservative Republicans because of these viral videos that he made of him basically picking fights with teachers unions and that sort of thing. It's actually kind of similar to your governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker. He became kind of a folk hero to people who basically wanted to shrink the size of government and reduce the power of public sector unions. But during Hurricane Sandy, Christie was seen as being too close to President Obama, which, while I think probably helpful back home in New Jersey, I think turned off a lot of Republicans. And so I think if you would ask Republicans who they think is more conservative and better aligns with their principles, I think a lot of Republicans would say Scott Walker aligns better with them than Chris Christie.
Well, and that's one of the threads of reaction to this has been, look, a Tea Party-affiliated guy lost in Virginia, a moderate won handily in a state that votes Democrat in presidential elections. Is there any kind of lesson there, or are these such unique cases that it's hard to learn anything?
I think the lesson from Virginia, well, let's put it this way. If Chris Christie were on the ballot in Virginia, I think he would have been elected governor. I also think that Bill Bowling, who your listeners probably have never heard of, but he's the lieutenant governor of Virginia, a Republican, and he was sort of seen as being next in line to run for governor, but Ken Cuccinelli basically cut in front of him, and that's politics, and Cuccinelli got the nomination. I think if Bowling had been nominated in Virginia, maybe he'd be the next governor of Virginia. And Bowling is sort of a more, he's more acceptable to the business crowd here. And while not really moderate, I don't know if Christie's really moderate either, they aren't as obviously socially conservative as Cuccinelli is.
Just real briefly, just about out of time, I don't want to leave out New York City, first Democratic mayor in 20 years. Any lessons there for Democrats?
It's interesting that Bill de Blasio won in New York, and also the probably more liberal, labor-oriented candidate also won the mayoral election in Boston. And I think that after 20 years of voters in New York City sort of voting for these moderate business Republicans, you know, they decided to sort of go to their roots as being a very Democratic city and voting for, you know, a pretty liberal mayoral candidate, one of the most liberal mayors of New York City, at least in recent history. So, we'll have to see. But I think a lot of it is just, New York City is a very liberal Democratic city. And for the first time in 20 years, it voted its reputation.
Kyle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you.
That's Kyle Kondik. He's managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics.
Coming up, our guest says we're in a state of denial when it comes to concussions in football, and it's time we started talking about it. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Our next guest says America is in a state of denial when it comes to football. While two recent documentaries have shed light on the game's concussion crisis, he says it's back to business as usual for coaches, players, and parents.
And he says what we need now is a national town hall meeting on the game to collectively address the health problems football creates.
Joining us now is Ken Reed, Sports Policy Director at League of Fans. Ken, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you.
So the documentaries I mentioned, United States of Football, League of Denial, two documentaries that tried to shine some light on concussions in football. Were they successful? Did they get us talking?
Well, I think there's generally a little more awareness across the country on the issue of brain trauma in general and concussions in particular in football, but it hasn't moved from awareness to understanding to attitude change and behavior change. I think it's back to business as usual and all the way down to the little leagues, which is pretty dangerous in my mind.
It's your sense that people maybe saw the documentary or heard about it, said, oh, that's a shame, that's too bad, and then went back to watching, coaching, participating as they always did.
Well, we're in a unique situation here because there's little doubt that football is America's favorite sport, and there's also little doubt today that football is hazardous to the human brain. So the issue is, how can we reconcile those two facts, and can they be reconciled? And I think at the very least, we need to have a serious discussion about football for our kids, because kids' brains are even more vulnerable than adults. They're still developing, and the risks are even higher.
What do we know about the impact of football and the impact of these injuries on young people in the U.S.?
Well, There's a lot of research out there. Just one thing that I'll throw out is that in any given season of high school football, 20% of the players sustain a brain injury. And even scarier than that is because these schools don't have trainers and doctors to the degree that college and NFL teams do, that 40.5% of these high school athletes who suffer concussions return to action prematurely. And that's really dangerous because then you can get second impact syndrome, which can shut down the brain, basically, and sometimes result in death.
You know, I don't know. I know there's Pee Wee football. How young are kids starting playing tackle football?
6 or 7 years old. Mm-hmm. And one of the deals with the kids that young is if you go watch one of the games, it's kind of cute because they're not going that fast and it looks like they're kind of just hugging each other. But in reality, the brain impact, in fact, there was a study done that showed the G-forces from Pee Wee football are very similar to adults. So
really?
It's dangerous. Yeah, even at that young a level when they're not hitting each other that hard, they're still suffering a lot of damage.
Well, and then there's the idea, or probably the fact, that kids' brains are still growing and developing and therefore more vulnerable. Is that part of why you want to start focusing on this younger level?
Well, yeah, that plus the fact that there's over 3 million kids playing youth football and over 1 million kids playing high school football. So the numbers are just humongous relative to the number of people playing college and NFL football. So I think the fact that we have that many kids playing football and the fact that their brains are more vulnerable as they're developing and their necks aren't as strong, which leads to more of the whiplash effect, that we definitely need to shift the focus to the younger kids.
Well, before we get to how you want to change that focus, there is the argument that, you know, there are positives of football. The teamwork, the exercise, camaraderie. Yes, there are some risks, but the positives outweigh those negatives. How would you answer that?
Well, I think those are legitimate positives. And just to clarify, I played 6 years of football myself. My dad was a football coach. I still enjoy watching the game, although it's harder knowing what's going on with inside their skulls, but I'm not anti-sports at all. I'm just looking at something that is real here, just like when we were looking at smoking in high schools, you know, and we banned that. I think the same thing needs to be discussed. Well, what are we going to do with football in our youth? And what's troubling to me is the research I've looked at is there's no magic bullet out there. There's not a helmet that can be designed that's going to protect our brains, because helmets were designed to protect skull fractures, and they do a good job with that. But in terms of the brain, it's like Jell-O inside of a bowl, and when you get hit, whether it's in the head directly or even in the chest, it's a whiplash effect, and the brain smashes against the side of the skull, and that's what actually causes the concussion. So there's not a helmet that's going to protect that brain from smashing against the side of the skull.
You recently wrote that we need a national town hall meeting to talk about the issues you're raising here. What would that look like? What are you hoping it could accomplish?
Well, as we started this conversation, there are some great documentaries out. There's been some articles written. People are more aware, but it stops there. It's like we're really in a state of denial. We just go back to how things were. I think what we need is a national town hall, and I think ideally ESPN would be the host of that. It could be sponsored by the Pro League, NFL, and other football organizations. And it's not just football. It's other sports that are dealing with this too. But ESPN in particular, because they were working on the documentary called League of Denial and backed out at the last second. So I kind of think that they obviously did it for business reasons. NFL is a big business partner, but I think they owe it to the country as journalists to at least spend an hour on a national town hall to discuss this issue.
We've got a caller. We've got John in Windsor with us. John, hi. What do you think about this?
Well, I think that it's not just football that you need to have it take a look at studying. I mean, soccer, for instance, is there are huge brain injuries in soccer because, in that sport, people inherently use their head, which is not used, does not have a helmet, to head the ball into the goal. You know, field hockey, another one. Of course, regular hockey. So I don't think that this is just something that you can say football is the main problem. And I have to say, I played football in high school, and I think that I may have suffered a concussion. That was 35 years ago. I think that this is inherent in almost all sports that people are involved with.
All right, John, thanks. So, Ken, you briefly mentioned this should expand to other sports. Is there a case to be made, though, for having a main focus initially on football?
Well, football, I mean, if you look at the stats, to the caller's point, there are concussions, obviously, that occur in other sports. But football, by far, per capita, number of players, has the most concussions. Now, soccer, especially for girls, would be second. Hockey, obviously. But football, by far, is the main sport that causes the most concussions. And it's also the sport where violently striking the opponent is a key part of the game. Now, with soccer, the headers can be banned for kids 14 and under, and you can still have a game that looks an awful lot like soccer. Hockey, you can cut back on the fighting. You can eliminate fighting. You can get rid of some of the cheap shots along the boards, and it still looks like hockey. But if you take out the violence in football, unless you go to flag football, it's not the same sport. So it's a bigger issue that we have to deal with at football.
So what would success look like to you in terms of this national town hall meeting or changing the conversation? What kind of changes on the ground, on the football field for kids would you like to see?
Well, I think the conversation, the town hall, would include medical doctors and researchers, youth sports organizers, all the way up to the NFL. So we get a well-rounded panel discussion going. But I think ultimately, in my view, what's got to happen is we got to have much less contact in practices. You can limit tackling and blocking and things like that. Even the NFL's gone to very limited contact during the week. A big thing is that there's got to be strict return-to-play guidelines. If there's any sign of a concussion at all, the kid needs to be pulled out and sent to a doctor and cleared by a doctor before they can go back into action. And then I think we just got to look at the bigger picture of the rules of football. I mean, is there a way where we could have linemen standing up and so they're not banging directly head-to-head? You know, obviously we're in NFL and college, we're already trying to get rid of spearing where they're leading with a head. So there's a lot of things like that that can be done to make it incrementally safer. But the question is whether you can get there and make it safe enough to protect the brain, especially in young kids. I truly think high school football in the next decade is in danger, if for no other reason that more research comes out, there's going to be more lawsuits, and with more lawsuits means the insurance costs for school districts to sponsor something like football are going to be cost prohibitive, and they might have to drop it.
All right, Ken, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
That's Ken Reed, Sports Policy Director at League of Fans. That's a sports reform project.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll learn about the history of America through 101 objects as selected by Smithsonian Institute, everything from Sitting Bull's drawing book to Lincoln's stovepipe hat.
In our Hidden Wisconsin segment, we'll meet a father in Milwaukee who now is trying to help men be other men be better fathers.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a look at the life and times of comedian Richard Pryor. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Fall is filled with rituals, both celebratory and wistful, as we prepare for winter.
In today's Wisconsin Life, writer Christy Clancy has an annual ritual around her cabin.
Even with the fireplace, we can't escape the cold. It rises through the floor and seeps in through the cracks under the doors. The insulation we pumped into the walls will extend the season by a few weeks, but the windows don't have storms. There's no boiler, not even a basement, to put one in. Our East Troy Lake cottage forces us to pick the day summer will end. We stuff the grill, kayak, and sun umbrella through the barn doors of the tiny garage. We dismantle the water softener. We turn on a bare light bulb in the cabinet with the pipes. Finally, we pour antifreeze in the toilet and cover the furniture with sheets, like corpses. It's hard to leave. The house is charming the way a lake house should be, with beadboard on the walls and ceilings, a screened-in porch, and a real cottage smell that makes everyone who comes here nostalgic for some other cottage they'd been to when they were kids. The lake is big and spring-fed with a sandy bottom, giant lily pads, and channels that lead to other lakes to explore. We have a closing checklist we've developed over the years, one that grew with trial and error. One year we forgot to empty the pantry. When we returned the next spring, mice had torn through boxes of pancake mix, oatmeal, and spaghetti noodles and had made nests in our dresser drawers. Another year, moths had chewed through the wool blankets my mother knit for us because we didn't seal them in plastic boxes. This cottage forces us to be slaves to the seasons. I grow increasingly aware that it requires youth and strength to own this little old house, and that someday the work might be too much for us. Sometimes we talk about winterizing it. Winterize. Such a funny word. As much as I love it here, I resist this idea. Most of the cottages on Lake Beulah have been torn down and replaced with suburban houses, even mansions. They have beating hearts all year long. They might be more fancy and expensive than ours, but what they've gained in comfort and use still seems to add up to a loss of something essential. Like most rituals, this process of opening and closing, this cycle of expectation and melancholy, helps my life make sense. It forces me to appreciate my dimming youth and acknowledge the way seasons and life change. It encapsulates memories and makes summers feel like they're suspended, always happening. I think of the people who have been here and see happily married couples that are now divorced, sick friends drinking wine on an Adirondack chair, perfectly healthy. I see children who are looking at colleges learning how to water ski for the first time. It's as if these memories get preserved in the icy cold. Most houses offer comfort and warmth, but this cottage tells me to go away, forget about it for the winter. So I leave, knowing it will be here, waiting for me.
Christy Clancy is a writer and professor of English at Beloit College.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council.
You can get more information at wisconsinlife.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Richard Pryor is considered one of the greatest stand-up comedians of all time. He's been described as outrageous, fearless, provocative, profane, angry.
Well, our next guest co-wrote a biography of Richard Pryor with his brother, David Henry. We have with us now Joe Henry. He is co-author of Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him. Joe is also a singer-songwriter. Joe, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it sounds as though you sort of got interested in Richard Pryor. At least the whole thing sort of started for you with a song, Richard Pryor Addresses a Tearful Nation. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the short version of the story, if there is such a thing, is that I wrote a song where I sing in first person as Richard Pryor. I didn't set out to do it. I just realized as I was writing it that that's who I believed was speaking. And I don't mention his name in the song. The title tells you how to hear it as him. And because I was on a record label at that time that was owned by Disney, and they were terrified of any exposure where Richard was concerned, because he's always been such a hot-button, volatile character, they insisted that I either change the title of the song, which I wouldn't do, leave it off my record, which I was not going to do, because I had recorded it with the legendary jazz saxophonist Ornette Coleman, and it was significant to me, or get Richard's permission. So I set out to do the latter, and in so doing, I met him and became friendly with both he and his wife, ex-wife then, but then they remarried. She was wife number 5 and 7, Jennifer Lee. And so I released the record, and Esquire magazine asked me to write a piece for them about Richard and how the idea of him led me to work with the great Ornette Coleman. And based on that piece, which was Richard and his wife found very moving, they asked me if I would write a screenplay based on his life. And I, of course, said, I'm not a screenwriter, I'm a songwriter. And they said, we know, we don't want a screenwriter. So I said, well, if I'm going to take this on, I'm going to get some help, and I'm going to ask my brother to help me, because he is a screenwriter, and we've always talked about doing something together. So we spent about 2 years completely on spec, writing a screenplay that we finished and was very close to being made into a film, and then the plug got pulled on it, as often happens. We sort of went away licking our wounds for, you know, a couple of years maybe. And then one day my brother David said, you know, we've done all this research, and we've put all this thought into it. Who knows what will happen with our script? Let's just write a book. And, yeah. and so we did.
And that's the book we have today. Well, so obviously, you know, going back to when you wrote that song, you know, Richard Pryor had been pinging around in your head for a while, so there's obviously something about him that resonates for you. What is it? How would you describe your draw to him?
Oh, his, you know, beautiful, flawed, fractured humanity. I've always been attracted to artists, you know, who unveil that so fully and unselfconsciously to a point. I saw him on TV the first time, maybe I was, you know, 11 years old, and I just reacted to him. You know, the beautiful thing about hearing things and witnessing things when you're, excuse me, when you're very young is that you don't know that you're being influenced, and you're very vulnerable to being influenced because you don't know that you have to make sense of it, or you don't ask yourself, you know, why does this mean anything to me? You just sort of go with it, you know, when it happens. And I sort of discovered Richard for myself about the same time that I discovered Bob Dylan. And, you know, they've both been with me ever since because, you know, Bob, like, has been a big deal for me as a songwriter, as he has been for most, you know, American folk-based songwriters of my generation. And Richard was there right alongside in that same moment, you know, giving evidence to what it means to be an artist who makes their whole heart completely available, even when it isn't pretty.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone would have had an excuse for having a life that was, you know, a complete wreck without redeeming value, it would have been Richard Pryor. He was born in a brothel. He struggled with addictive episodes throughout his entire life. He almost killed himself by self-immolation. And this is a guy who struggled with a lot, and yet he came out of that and became this edgy voice that was sort of speaking truth. Can you talk a little bit about how he came out of that background, living in this brothel, to emerge as a comedian on the scene?
Well, a lot of people, you know, survive absolutely heinous upbringings. I mean, I don't know if I've read about many lives that were as disastrous as Richard's upbringing was. And, you know, none of it his fault. You know, he was abused in every way that a young person can be abused, and grew up in just the most wicked circumstances. And yet, the people who actually survive that and find a voice are offering a tremendous amount to the rest of us, because, you know, we all grow through the collective experiences of others, you know. And I just think that he, you know, he was a rare person that was able to maintain that balance for, you know, longer than it, you know, seemed possible in some ways, between being the walking wounded and finding, developing, and maintaining a platform from which to speak. You know, there are people who are seriously hurt in their soul and don't know how to articulate that into some creative way that might offer something of value to others. There are some people who are beautiful technicians as far as artistry is concerned, but who don't have the soul to offer an audience that might be so moving as Richard's was.
I think it was Bob Newhart. I could be wrong about that, but I think he was the one who said that Richard Pryor drew the line between tragedy and comedy thinner than anybody else did. He seemed like he was incredibly vulnerable when he was out there on stage, and we have a clip that sort of illustrates a little bit about that. Let's listen.
I hope you think what I'm going to do is funny and laugh at me. I'm a comedian. And, yes, I'm a comedian. And I just like to relax because it's early in the morning and I'm sleepy. I don't want to fight or nothing. I just want to be mellow. I'm not a fighter. Never could fight. I had the moves, but I couldn't fight. The hitting part scared me.
Just a little clip there of Richard Pryor being kind of naked on stage about himself. Was that typical for him?
I think it was very typical. I mean, I think no great art happens without incredible vulnerability. I think that's absolutely a fact, as we now know it. And when Richard stood up, as he frequently did in his early days, and began his routines, as you just evidenced, saying, "I hope I'm funny," I think he really was hoping that people were going to not only find him funny, but find him acceptable. I think that's really what that meant when he said that, that he was offering himself, and he'd been told his whole life that he was without value. You know, when people grow up being so marginalized and maligned and hurt, I think it's really hard to ever believe in your own worth. And I think you hear that all the time, but I think that's also what made him so gifted, as to be able to stand on a stage and reflect back not only his own experiences, but, you know, the faces of others. Because, you know, what's funny is what's true. People laugh when they recognize truth in what somebody shares. That's a historic fact. The laugh of recognition is what that really is. And Richard had an uncanny ability to stand up in front of audiences, for instance, you know, black and white audiences, and challenge them and not offend anybody, because he was so vulnerable and he was so charming that no matter how he challenged audiences, rather than getting angry, people would say, "That's right, that's what we do, that's just how we are." You know, mm-hmm. When he would dress down a white audience, coming from anybody else, those same words might have been wildly offensive. But he did it with such heart, and he had such love in his soul, damaged as he was, that people could take it in. People wanted to take it in. And that's an incredibly rare thing.
We're talking right now to Joe Henry, co-author of the book Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him.
We'll continue the conversation in a few minutes. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Thanks, Kristen. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our conversation with Joe Henry right now. He's the co-author with his brother David of the book Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him. Now, we talked about the vulnerable side of Richard Pryor. He also had this incredibly edgy side. I mean, he was right there looking over the cliff at the edge there. He used language that was difficult. He talked about race. He was very honest. And I wonder, at that time, how unusual was what Richard Pryor was doing, especially in the way that he changed the conversation about race in America?
Well, I think it was as unusual then as it would be now to see somebody stand up and speak truth with that kind of clarity. And by the way, when you say, you know, we look at one side, you know, the vulnerable side, and now we talk about the edgy side, I don't personally think those are separate sides. I think his edginess is a direct result of his intense fragility. You know, I think he, you know, he, coming from the world and from which he came, I think, you know, erecting a persona that was edgy and tough in any kind of a way was a direct result of protecting himself, because he was in fact so vulnerable. But he was a revolutionary, and you know, he was the most subversive kind, because people didn't recognize him necessarily. His audiences didn't know how to see him as a revolutionary in the real time of that moment. You know, he's making them laugh, and he's exposing them to thought that they had maybe never taken on, and opened their minds in many ways. And that's a particularly deft thing to do when people don't know that you're doing it.
And so he's out there, he's being vulnerable, and he's using the N-word on stage a lot. How did people take that at the time?
Oh, well, about like you'd imagine. I mean, you know, certainly when he was in his early days coming up in the Chitlin circuit, and in the early days of the nightclub years, which were pretty rough, and people were sort of, you know, reinventing themselves and a form in real time, I'm not sure it was unusual to hear a man in that context use the N-word, but the fact that he somehow launched himself onto the mainstream stage in front of white America and continued to talk the same way he had always talked, that was shocking. People weren't used to that. At the same time, though, I think it's really interesting to note that when he went on TV, for instance, his very historic appearance, episode 7 of the very first year of Saturday Night Live, you know, I think a lot of people wondered, you know, if he's got to clean it up for TV, will it still work? Well, if you go back and watch that episode, which is available on DVD and on YouTube, you know, he's cleaned up his language, but none of the energy or none of the depth of his content is lost. You know, he had to shift his rhythm a little bit, perhaps, but nothing he was offering is diminished, which I think is fascinating, because so many people associate, you know, his edginess with his bad language. And, of course, that's a big part of his cadence. He punctuated his routines with the language of the street. But what was really edgy about him, you know, were the ideas.
Looking back at his career, you know, you and your brother have researched it exhaustively. What do you think is the pinnacle of his career, or the moment where you really feel like that is Richard Pryor distilled, you know, down to an essence? This is it.
Oh, for me, and I would recommend it to anybody who might be entering the stream, you know, sort of anew, the original Richard Pryor Live in Concert, the 1979 film that was recorded at a concert in Long Beach, is still the greatest single stand-up routine ever filmed. You know, you get a man alone on stage for an hour and 10 minutes or something, you know, a stool, a microphone, and a glass of water, and he talks about everything that matters, you know, love, death, sex, God, you know, religion, race, his mortality, his family, his upbringing, the police, celebrity. It's unbelievable how much ground, you know, how broad a canvas he paints. And, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've seen it, and I'm never not sucked into it if I revisit it. I think that's sort of, you know, I'm not saying he didn't do work that equaled that, but if you wanted to see in a flash, you know, the breadth of his artistry, it's all right there.
We don't have that particular clip, but I do want to remind people just how funny he was. Let's listen to this.
Did you see The Exorcist? Yeah. See, the movie would have been over for me. If I'd have been in the movie, it would have been over. If I'd have walked in the house and heard, "Run!" That would have been it. Wouldn't have had to go no further. Right, with all the extras? No, no, no. Brothers exercise the devil every day, though, with two words: be cool. Because the movie would have been over, right, if it had been a black man in the movie, because you don't be vomiting on no brother's clothes.
Little bit of everything there in that clip from Richard Pryor. What do you think about that one?
Well, I always just, you know, I always have a smile on my face when I hear his voice. You know, there's a certain light in his delivery to me, especially from that era. You know, he's so buoyant in a way. You know, I just, I'm a sucker for him. What can I tell you?
So one thing we know about Richard Pryor, we know he was a revolutionary. He was incredibly funny. We also know about his substance abuse problems. And he talked openly about them. I remember seeing him on TV, actually, I think when I was a kid sometime, and he was, maybe it was Barbara Walters or someone interviewing him about the time he tried to, I guess, kill himself. He set himself on fire. How do you think he processed that? And then kind of, how did it come out the other side in his art as a comedian?
He never did really come out the other side. I mean, it's sort of the one thing that he was never completely honest about. You know, he got on stage and he was brutally honest about everything in his life, except, you know, he always talked about his drug use very candidly, but always as if it was in the past. And it was never really in the past. You know, from the mid-70s on, he talked about how foolish he was when he used to do cocaine. And, you know, he was as deep in it at that moment as he was ever going to be. That's just a fact. I don't think he really was free of it until his MS had crippled him to the point where he was strapped in a wheelchair and unable to use his body, and would have been powerless to use without the intervention of someone else.
And you met him at that time, right? He had MS by the time you met him.
Oh, sure. You know, I mean, people ask me all the time, they read, you know, a press release from my publicist and say, you know, you knew Richard Pryor. Well, I did spend time with him. But at the time that I knew him, I have to say that, you know, at that point he was strapped in a wheelchair and, for the most part, unable to speak any longer. Though, you know, I maybe heard him say two words in the, you know, three, four, five times I was at his house for an afternoon. And yet you look in his eyes and, you know, I knew he was there. I mean, he was mentally there, which was sort of shocking and heartbreaking to realize in some ways. But there was something very mysterious about it too, because I would get home from visiting him on an afternoon, and I would take music for him to listen to. He was a great lover of jazz, as I am, and I would sit and talk to him and play records or whatever. And by the time I got home, I remembered the afternoon as if we'd actually been conversing somehow. It's a strange thing in, you know, to think back on that and wonder, you know, I really felt as if we had been having an exchange, not just me talking at somebody. And of course I never knew him any other way. So that's just a kind of a strange, you know, human phenomenon that there are more ways to converse than just verbally, you know, as we know.
We're out of time, but Joe, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Oh, it's my great pleasure, and I thank you for your time.
We've been talking to Joe Henry. He is co-author with his brother David of the book Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him. It was released yesterday.
Coming up, a hearing on a proposed state law on co-sleeping here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back.